Okay, get clicking if you like that sort of thing. I think it's time to get started. Okay, so, yeah. So last time we were talking about these push-down automata, which are basically like finite state machines in that they've got a control unit that can be in any number of finite number of states. They can read an input string, as before, one character at a time, from left to right. But they've also got some extra memory in form of a stack, where they can push on as much data as they like and then retrieve it later. So this memory can only be manipulated in the stack fashion, so you can't get at what's buried underneath without popping off the things that are on top. Okay. So the idea is that these push-down automata are going to give us exactly the power we need to recognize context-free languages. Okay. So let's see if... So we looked at a little example of the execution of a push-down automaton on some strings of brackets. So let me just go through quickly the mathematical details of what a push-down automaton actually is. So as before, we've got some finite set of states. And I'll call these control states, because they're the states of that control unit box on the left. So there will also be some other kind of state hanging around, which is the state of the stack. So I'm just going to distinguish these ones by calling these control states. So the controller can only be in a finite number of states, although we've got the stack in addition to that as well. The input string is consists of letters from symbols from an input alphabet, which, as before, we'll call sigma. I'm also going to give myself a stack alphabet called gamma, which may or may not be related to sigma. They're consisting of, these are just values that you're allowed to push on the stack. So we've got a finite alphabet of entries it's possible to store on the stack, including a special symbol called bottom, which is the one we're going to use just to mark the bottom of the stack. And it'll typically be when that bottom symbol gets popped off the stack, so the stack's genuinely empty, then we have that'll signify the end of our execution. We'll pick out one of our states, our control states, as the start state of the machine. And now we give ourselves a transition relation, which is the thing that's more complicated here than for ordinary NFAs. So for a transition, we've got the state we're in before the transition, the input symbol that can cause the transition to happen, and we also allow silent transitions that don't consume an input symbol, so we have either an input symbol or an epsilon. And our transition is also allowed to take account of the symbol, the stack symbol at the top of the stack. So the idea is if we see this input symbol and this stack symbol on the top of the stack, then we're allowed to make this transition, assuming we're in this state. And then, so what happens, we go to a new state, which is this queue here, and we replace the top symbol of the stack, so we pop that off and replace it with 0 or 1 or possibly more new stack symbols. So we're allowed to do just one pop from the stack at each stage and allow any number of pushes. So if you look at how these things worked, that's what they did. We had just a single state here, so we don't need to worry about that. Input symbol, stack symbol, sequence of stack symbols that you put onto the stack. Okay. So you're given all that gubbins, and then from all that, we can actually make ourselves a state machine that's more the normal kind of state machine we've been used to, only it's a state machine with infinite number of states. Because if you think about the machine as a whole, we've got these control states, but if you think about the state of the machine's in as a whole, it's got the control state and it's got the current state of a stack. So I'll call machine states the states for the whole commotion. So a choice of control state plus a stack state, this is just the list of the things on the stack, that'll constitute the total state of the machine at a given moment in time. And then we can say, well, we're allowed to go from a total state of this kind to a total state of this kind via an A transition if we've got a transition in our set of transitions here which lets us do things. So this says if we see the input symbol A, we've got an X on the top of the stack, which we do here, then we're allowed to go to state Q prime and replace the X on the top of the stack by B. Okay. So this machine gives rise to a state machine which is exactly like an NFA, only it's not a non-deterministic finite automaton, it'll be a non-deterministic infinite automaton, just because we've got infinitely many states here. But it's exactly the same thing. Just imagine a state graph that's kind of infinitely big. So one of these gives rise to a thing that you're used to, only with an infinite number of states. And then once we've got this thing, we can, exactly as before, define the language accepted by it. Okay, so it doesn't matter that we've got infinitely many states, we've still got some state transitions and some accepting states and things like that. And so we say that the language accepted by this infinite state machine is by definition the language accepted by our pushdown automaton. And in this case we say that our machine accepts by empty stack, because it's when our stack empties that's our condition for finishing the computation. There's a minor variation you can do on that, which is you can do something that's more in the spirit of what we did before, which is you can, in addition to all this stuff here, you can equip your pushdown automaton with a declared set of accepting states. And then you can say your string is accepted if you can do a computation that ends in one of those accepting states. That's not a big deal, because whether you choose to accept by accepting state or accept by empty stack, you can always transform your machine into one of the other kind, so that accepts the same language. So there's no big deal in computational power whether we accept by empty stack or by more traditional accepting states. Okay, so the theorem, the big theorem, which I'll only outline the proof of, is that a language is context-free if and only if there's a non-deterministic pushdown automaton, that's the thing I've just defined, such L is the language accepted by it. So NPDAs are to context-free languages exactly what NFAs or DFAs are to regular languages. Okay, there's an exact match-up. Any context-free language, there's a push-down automaton for, and vice versa. Okay. Now, there is an important difference between what's going on here and what was going on with finite automata, which is that with finite automata, we had this power set construction, subset construction, yeah, which allowed us to take any NFA, turn it into a DFA, possibly with lots more states. Okay. Now that construction is actually unavailable here, so although it's possible to give a reasonable definition of deterministic pushdown automata, it's not true that we can always transform an NPDA into a DPDA. And actually, in the PDA setting, DPDAs are strictly less powerful than NPDAs. There are languages that you can be recognized using NPDAs, and so they're context-free languages, but there's no, sadly, there's no DPDA corresponding to them. So that's an important difference between the regular and the context-free setting. So you can't just switch to things being deterministic, okay? Well, that's a bit of a shame, because it's deterministic machines that we know we can run efficiently, yeah? So when we have a non-deterministic machine, we sort of have to, you know, keep track of all the states it could be in, whereas with a deterministic machine, we can just trundle through looking up the transition we perform at each stage. So deterministic machines are very efficient to run. So a bit of a pity we can't always find a deterministic machine, of this kind anyway, to recognize a given context-free language. But what we can do is we can ask, well, is there some special class of context-free languages which we can cope with using deterministic machines? So rather than setting our ambitions on coping with the whole class of all possible context-free languages, supposing we just narrowed our sights a bit and said, well, let's just look at the easy ones, the ones that we can process using a deterministic machine. Does that still give us a reasonable class of languages that's powerful enough to do interesting programming language stuff and so on? In fact, that it turns out that you can do that, and you do get something interesting and useful, and in fact we'll be able to do efficient parsing in a deterministic fashion, and that will be coming up shortly. So we're going, the general theorem says if you want all context-free languages, you need NPDAs. We can settle for something intermediate between regular and context-free languages, that's still useful and that lets us do efficient parsing using basically a deterministic PDA. So that's what we're going to come on to. Let me outline how the proof of this theorem works, how it is that in general we can get from a context-free grammar to an NPDA and back again. Okay. Now this is quite important, because the idea behind this argument here is precisely the idea that we're going to use in the next lecture to develop parsing algorithms. So this is the basic idea of, given a context-free grammar, how can we design a machine that somehow processes it, that somehow recognizes strings in it? So it's worth understanding how this works, because this will be the key idea to how we can actually construct a good parser, even though our good parser will be deterministic rather than non-deterministic, but it's still pretty close. So let's say we're given a context-free grammar with certain sets of non-terminals, terminals, production rules, and a certain start symbol. Now it turns out that not only can we always turn that into an NPDA, we can always get away with an NPDA with just a single state. Okay, so that makes things nice and simple. We've just got a single state, and the transitions always go from that state to itself. But the interesting stuff is happening not in the states, but on the stack. Okay, so let's give ourselves an input, the input alphabet as the set of terminals, and stack alphabet, well, we'll allow ourselves both terminals and non-terminals to push on the stack. And we'll give us the start symbol of the grammar will be the one we take as our initial stack symbol, the one I wrote as bottom earlier. So the idea is, roughly, that the stack is going to record, we're processing a string, right? And typically we'll be some of the way through it. Don't know where the chalk is, but you can imagine. Okay. Right. We'll be some of the way through the string, and we've processed these characters. And the idea is that the state of the stack is going to record a guess at the shape of what's to come, the shape of the bit of the string that's to come. So let me just sneak one slide ahead to show you this. So here, you see the stack states are going to be look like this. And this is you can think of this as a guess that the bit of the input we haven't read yet has the form open brackets followed by an expression close brackets, blah, 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 blah. So we've read a certain amount of input, and the idea is that the stack is going to record a guess or a prediction at what's going to come next. So how do we turn our grammar into an NPDA? Well, for every rule in the grammar, I do need the
chalk now, I think. Yeah.
That's a pity. There's a really tiny piece here. That's not very good. It's another really good. See what I can do with these. Okay. The idea is, if we think the rest of the input is going to have the form x, b, y, z, where let's say x, y, z are non-terminals and b is some terminal, okay? And we decide that we're going to expand this x using some rule in the grammar we've got that x can go to c followed by w, okay? So then, that's the next challenge, find a rubber. Okay, so the idea is you can then pop the x off the stack, replace that with cw, and our new prediction about the remaining form of the input is a more detailed one, that it's form CWBYZ. So anytime we've got a production rule, we can silently, that's without consuming any input symbols, we can replace the left-hand side on the stack with the right-hand side on the stack. And then if we see that we've got a letter C on the stack, and we see that our input, this is our stack, right? This is our input tape. Now, supposing we're reading here, and we see we've got a C on the stack, then we can give ourselves a transition which just ticks this off against this C here. This says we're sort of expecting a C in the input. This says we've got a C, so we'll advance our read position off this off the stack. That's what that does. Okay, what I'm going to do, I'm going to work through an example. I'm going to work through an example sort of in real time on the board. But the example is on the next slide, right? So you don't need to copy down the example because you can look it up on the slide. But so that's there for the record in small print, okay? And this is what you need. This is what I'm going to need to point at while I'm doing the example. And the example, I just need to check what the string is for the example. So I'm going to parse the input string, open brackets x, close brackets, times 5 for this grammar. Okay, so we start off with our read. That's really annoying. I was looking forward to this because, one benefit, I think, of having live lectures is you can do things like this in real time on a blackboard, which would take a long time to annotate. You can follow it, work it through yourself in with the slides afterwards, but if you can see me doing it in real time and rubbing bits off, it's a good way to, you know, to execute an algorithm. So I hope the chalk holds out. Right, so our input symbols here. So this is our grammar for arithmetical expressions we had before. Okay, so let's move this up a bit. And this is going to be a stack. So we put the start, we're expecting the whole thing to be an expression, right? So we start off, we initialize the stack in this state, saying the whole thing is an expression, okay? Right, and so the idea is, what I had on the next slide is, right, so I've got the input read so far and the stack state. So So the idea is, right. So first, I'm going to think, what do I need to expand this expression to in order to generate this spring, this string? Spring. Okay. So the idea here is we make use of our non-determinism, and we non-deterministically guess that we're going to want to apply this rule. Okay. So we have a transition which doesn't read any input, but which just, and I'll just sort of, I sort of record what I'm doing over here. That goes to exp times exp. We just notice that we've got a rule like this, and that will let us pop the exp off the stack and replace it with exp times exp. Okay. So we just guess that that's the right rule to apply, right? Because we're clever, right? Or because we've got it. Because we've sneakily looked ahead. But this is where we exploit the non-determinism, the idea that just as long as there's some correct sequence of guesses, then we're okay. And now, let's see. I notice that I've also got a rule, exp goes to brackets, exp brackets. So I notice that I can pop this exp off the stack and replace that, again, this is just a lucky guess, by brackets, exp brackets. Okay. Now, so far, both of those are epsilon transitions, so I haven't actually read it advanced, I haven't actually consumed any of the input yet. But now I notice that I've got an open bracket in the input, and my stack tells me that I'm expecting an open bracket. So I say, well, that's very good. Let's pop that off, and let's advance this here. Okay. And now you notice the bit of the string I haven't read yet, x close brackets times 5, does indeed have the form expression close brackets times expression. Okay, so at each stage of the computation, this is a prediction, as it happens, a correct prediction of the form that the remainder of the string is going to take. Okay, so I forgot to write that. This is expanded to. This is just a thing you can do if you record what rules you're applying at each stage. Okay? And now I say, right, I notice I've got a rule that exp can go to a var. So I apply that, pop that. That goes to a var. So we've got var times exp there. And then I've got another rule that says a var can go to an x, so I pop that, do the same thing there. And then say, we're expecting an x, we've got an x, that's good. Advance the read position, pop that off. Okay. And now my stack has remembered for me that I'm now expecting a closed bracket, which is good, because we wouldn't have known that otherwise. And we look, lo and behold, we've got a closed bracket, so we can now advance our read position there, pop that one off. And now, our stack is magically telling me that I'm expecting the next symbol to be times. And it is. So we pop that off, advance to there. Okay. And now, finally, I just get that other tiny bit of chalk wherever it went. Okay. Can you see what I do next? I'm going to... What am I going to do? What should I do next? So the stack's telling me I'm expecting the remainder of the input to be an expression, and the input symbol I've got is a 5, which is indeed an expression. So putting one. Right. So I want to expand this expression to actually to num. Okay, so I've got a rule that says exp can go to num. So I'm allowed to pop this off the stack, put a num in its place, and then pop that off the stack, put a 5 in its place, and then match that. And then you'll notice that the point at which we've run out of input exactly magically coincides with the point at which our stack empties. So that's very satisfying. That's game over, and we've won. Okay. So the idea is the stack keeps track of what's supposed to be coming next, the form of what's supposed to be coming next. And at each stage, you can either expand, if there's a non-terminal on top of the stack, you can expand that using one of the rules to say in more detail what the form of that non-terminal is. Or if there's a terminal on the top of the stack, you can hopefully, that's predicting that the next symbol of the input string will be that terminal. So hopefully it is, and you just match it and continue. And you notice if you keep track of what you've been doing along the way, so that's all done there. And what I've actually written here is I've written the bit of input we have already read, okay, rather than the bit we haven't. So the bit we have already read is growing, and here's the stack here. But it turns out if you put this bit we have already read together with this bit which gives the shape of the bit we haven't already read, this basically, if you just stick a few arrows in, that basically is nothing other than a leftmost derivation of the string in question. Okay? So remember, a derivation is a sequence of things like this where you derive each one from the previous one, and the leftmost one is the one where you expand the leftmost non-terminal, which is what we're doing because these are all terminals, right? And the leftmost non-terminal is going to be the one that's sort of at the top of the stack here when there is one. So basically, a computation of this machine that accepts this is doing nothing other than tracing out a leftmost derivation. So if we just sort of log the transitions we've made along the way, we'll have a leftmost derivation of this string. And leftmost derivation, as you remember, or any kind of derivation, can be seen as instructions for building a syntax tree for the string. So if we complete this computation, then we've verified that the string is indeed in the language. And moreover, the computation that we've done along the way gives us the way to build the syntax tree. Okay? So if we can do one of these accepting computations, then we know how to have parsed our sentence. So that's good. Except that we've cheated, because all the interesting, the whole interesting part of this is, right. The whole interesting part is to guess which rule to use when, which rule to apply when. And we've just said, well, we're non-deterministic, so we just magically guess which rule when to apply when. So that's why this algorithm, as it stands, isn't great for parsing, because it seems to suppose that you already know the answer of how the thing should be parsed, because you know which rule to apply when. So all this computation is really doing is checking that the string's in the language, given that you already know what the parse tree should be. Anyway, what's this slide supposed to be about? Well, this slide's supposed to be about going in the other direction, going from an NPDA to a context-free grammar. And I won't... Yeah. So basically, what I say here is, if you first of all think just about machines with just one state, then you can do a construction that's almost the exact reverse of what I've just told you. I've just told you how to get from a context-free grammar to a one-state NPDA. You can do almost reverse of that, get from an NPDA back to a context-free grammar. Then if you've got an NPDA with lots of states, you can, as it happens, replace that one, an equivalent one, with just one state. And basically, you do that by, instead of using the states to serve any useful purpose, you store all relevant state information on the stack. If you're interested in this, you can look it up in COSEN, but I won't say any more about that. Okay, so here's the slide I thought I had up when I was saying, right, we've seen that NPDAs exactly match context-free grammars in terms of their power for defining languages. So we've got exactly the right level of computational power here. And accepting computations, they don't just tell us the string's legal, they tell us how to build a syntax tree for it. But the problem, the reason we've cheated, is that computations here are non-deterministic. This only works because we've allowed ourselves the ability to correctly guess which production to apply at each stage. Okay? If only we had something like this, but deterministic, okay, then we'd have an efficient parsing algorithm, because we'd just have sort of some instructions for what to do at each stage, just a little bit of pushing and popping at each stage. We just work our way through a string, and then we have a computation that traces out the shape of a leftmost derivation, and then we would have won. So, yes, my idea is, as I mentioned earlier, we can see, we can sort of, one option at this point is to cheat and say, well, let's make the problem easier for ourselves by looking at special context-free grammars such that the corresponding PDA does happen to be deterministic. Can we already do some interesting stuff with just that? And I hope to convince you that we can. So we're going to look at efficient parsing for a slightly restricted class of context-free grammars. And later in the course, in Morella's part, we'll look at sort of semi-efficient parsers that work generally for any class of context-free grammars. So you can still do reasonably well for an arbitrary context-free grammar, but you can do very well if your context-free grammar is such that you can use a deterministic PDA for it. Okay, time to switch. Excuse me. Switch to the next lecture. Okay. Fortunately, is this okay? Right. Okay. So we're going to talk about a restricted class of context-free grammars called LL1 grammars, okay? So this is going to be a lot more powerful than regular grammars. They're going to let us do real interesting programming language stuff, but they're going to be suited to efficient deterministic parsing, and they're going to work using things called parse tables. So that's various topics we've got. So let's give some intuition here. Supposing we had an NPDA like I've told you about, but with just one state for simplicity. Okay. Now the intuition is that at each stage our pushdown automaton can see two things. So it can see the current input symbol, and it can see the topmost symbol of the stack. Okay. So, roughly speaking, we're going to say that. Our grammar is an LL1 grammar if, just from those two pieces of information and nothing else, it's possible to determine which transition. So if we're talking about grammars, then it would be which production to apply yet. If we're thinking in terms of automata, it would be which transition to apply yet. So roughly speaking, the idea is, in general, we might have a non-deterministic machine which at each stage has got a big choice of transitions. Supposing that, given the current input symbol and the topmost stack symbol, there's only one transition that we can single out as being the right one, okay, then just from these two pieces of information, we'll know what to do. So in that case, our parsing will be able to proceed deterministically, because we can only, as it were, without looking magically into the future, we'll be able to tell which rule to use, and parsing will be able to work efficiently. Okay, so this funny thing, LL1, unpacking that, the first L means it's an algorithm that reads the input from the left to the right, and that's sensible enough. We pretty much always do that. The second L means we're in effect building a leftmost derivation, because if you trace out, as we saw just then, if you trace out the sequence of transitions that you're doing, you get in effect, a leftmost derivation, where at each stage we're expanding the leftmost non-terminal. And the one means we only ever have to look one symbol ahead. Okay, so just the current input symbol by itself is going to give us, together with the topmost stack symbol, is going to give us enough information to decide which transition we're going to use. So there's a slightly subtle point here, which is that we allow ourselves to use the input symbol to help us choose a transition, even if it's an epsilon transition. In other words, even if it's a transition that doesn't itself consume that symbol and advance the input head. So we might use the fact that we've got an open brackets here to tell us which transition to apply. And then at the next stage, we've still got the open brackets there, so we use the open brackets again to tell us the next transition to apply. And eventually, we'll actually eat up this open brackets and move on to the next thing. So that means we are actually looking, in a strict sense, we're actually looking ahead one symbol, because we're seeing what the next symbol is, even if we don't use it. Okay. So the definition of an LL1 grammar, pretty much, is a grammar such that you only need these two pieces of information
to make the choice.
Okay, so it's by definition, it's a grammar for which parsing is going to be easy and deterministic. Okay, so it might not be obvious when a grammar is LL1, or might not be immediately obvious, but we're kind of defining the LL1 grammars to be grammars for which parsing is going to be quite easy. Okay, so here's another way of looking at it. So if I say that you only need to know the current input symbol and the current stack symbol, and they uniquely determine what production we apply, what that basically means is we can draw up a two-dimensional table or an array with possible input symbols along the top, possible stack symbols down the side, okay? And that will be a table in which we can simply look up whichever state we're in. We know the input symbol, we know the stack symbol, we just look up the corresponding entry in the array. That'll tell us the rule to apply. And a table like that is what's called a parse table. So let's look at how this works for the following following simple grammar. So here's another grammar that generates exactly the sequence of well-matched strings of brackets, okay? We can have the empty string, or T stands for sort of a top-level sequence, one which starts with a bracket and ends with the matching closed bracket. So T means from an open bracket to the closed bracket that matches it, and then we can have any other well-bracketed sequence after that. And a T itself can consist of an open bracket followed by a shorter well-bracketed sequence followed by a closed bracket. Okay? Now I've written a table here, and the columns are labelled by the input symbols, which are open bracket and closed brackets. And it's a slightly technical point. I've also allowed myself one extra symbol here, this dollar sign. This is an end of input marker. So secretly, yeah, I think of all my input strings as having a dollar sign at the plugged on the end, just to let me recognize when I've reached the end of the input, because my parser might have to do something special when it reaches the end of the input. But that's a slightly minor detail. So we have a columns for each of the genuine input symbols and a column for the end of the input marker. Stack symbols, well, on our stack we're going to allow both terminals and non-terminals, but I've only included rows here for the non-terminals. So this says if our input symbol is one of these and the top of our stack symbol is a non-terminal waiting to be expanded, then this is the rule you should use to expand it. So the idea is, if your stack tells you that you're expecting an S, you see an open bracket, okay? You've got a choice to make between these two rules, okay? Well, you're not going to choose the empty string in that case. You're going to choose TS, because you know that the T is going to give you something with an open bracket, okay? If you were expecting an S and you see a closed bracket, okay, then the S you're expecting can't be one of these, because if it was one of these, you'd be seeing an open bracket next. The S you're expecting must be the empty S, and the closed bracket must be something that comes after it. Likewise, if you're expecting an S, you see that you're at the end of the input, well, better be the empty string S. So from what you're expecting and what you see, you look up and see what to apply. Okay. There are blank entries in this table, because there are some situations that can simply never arise in the course of processing a legal string of the language. So if your machine ever got into a position where it told you you're expecting, say, a T, and you saw a closed bracket, okay, then you would know that the string wasn't a legal string of the language. You could flag up a parse error at that point. Okay, so saying a grammar is LL1 is roughly the same as saying there is a parse. It's possible to draw up a parse table, which uniquely tells you, for any non-terminal and any terminal, which is the right rule to apply. That's pretty much the definition of LL1 grammar. Okay, so once again, so this is basically the algorithm. It's basically the same algorithm as we saw before in the non-deterministic case, only now it's nice and deterministic because we've just got this table we look up at each stage to see which rule we apply. So what I was going to do, if I had chalk, was to go through this example on the board for the parsing of the of this input string, but with this on the slide. But I think the best thing is if I just sort of, oh, let me try. Okay, so the string I have in mind is two open brackets and two closed brackets. Okay, so. Okay, and we've got the parse table there. Okay, now I think I'll just do it here actually. Okay, so we start ourselves off. The remaining input string that we haven't read yet, hope you can see this, is the string here, and we just stick an end of input marker on it, a dollar at the end. And we start off our stack with just an S because we're expecting the whole thing to be an S. So notice that this does indeed have the form, this does indeed have the form of an S. Okay? And now, we see that our input starts with an open bracket and our stack has got an S on top, so we look up open bracket S. We see this rule which is telling us to expand the S to a TS. So we pop the S off, put a TS in its place. Okay? And we haven't consumed any of the input string yet. So now we've still got the first open bracket there, and we look up open bracket against T. Okay, open bracket against T. This tells us to expand the T to bracket S, close bracket. Okay, so we pop the T off, bracket S, close bracket. We still haven't consumed any of the input string, but now we see we've got an open bracket on at the top of the stack. So the stack is predicting that the remainder of the string has form open bracket S, close bracket S, okay, which it does if you look at it. But anyway, the point is it starts with an open bracket, so we can just check off that we do indeed have an open bracket as predicted. We read that open bracket, advance our read position to pass that, and pop this off the stack. Okay, so now our stack is correctly predicting. And in this case, it's more impressive as a prediction because we haven't been guessing which rules, applying magic to guess which rules to apply. We've just been using our parse table to tell us what to do next. And yet we see that in each of these lines, the stack correctly predicts the form that the rest of the input takes. I mean, a lot of these S's here are actually the empty S, but never mind. We see that. So you see, we sort of trundle our way through this, and then at some point we're going to look up, when we meet a closed bracket, we're going to look up the rule. If you see a closed bracket and you're expecting an S, then you do this. Then you apply this rule. And S goes to empty means simply pop the S off the stack. Okay. So once again, so this is completely deterministic, and the game, and we're here's the procedure we follow. At each stage, we start with just S on the stack. If the current input symbol is a non-terminal, we look up the entry in the table. If it's a terminal, we match it against if the current stack symbol is a terminal, we match it against the input symbol and continue. And if anything goes wrong in this process, anything happens that we're not expecting, that means the string's not a legal string in the language. So our parser can flag up a parse error to the user, the programmer, saying, "Oi, you wrote a load of nonsense there." Okay, so hopefully you can see this computation will not only check that our string is in the language, but just by keeping track of the rules that we apply as we go along, we can, like I did here, we can construct a leftmost derivation as we go along. Or if we prefer, just build a syntax tree as we go along. So every time we apply one of these rules, right, we're just growing a bit more of the... We can sort of grow it as we go along. Okay, so this not only tells us the strings in the language, it actually, we end up with the syntax tree, and that's what we want a parser to do. So, okay, I think I'm going to skip the clicker questions, sorry. I'm quite keen to catch up with myself. So this was, you might like to go away and think about this, because fortunately there isn't an answer on the next slide. So if you try and parse either of these two strings, which are clearly not strings in the language, what happens? How does the computation go wrong? You'll get into one of these error states, but it's worth seeing, you know, what goes wrong if we try and parse something that's not in the language. So the slogan to remember for this LL1 parsing, this predictive parsing, is, so the way to read the parse table is that the entry for the input symbol A and the non-terminal X tells us which rule to apply if we're expecting an X, we're expecting the next bit of an input to form X, and what we see is an A, okay? So the idea is we can decide what to do, the essence of LL1, is that we can decide what to do just from what we see and what we're expecting, okay? So quite obviously, very often, if we're expecting an X and we see an A, that will happen because the A in question is simply the first symbol of the X string that we're going to get. This non-terminal X stands for a certain phrase, and if this X eventually expands to some string beginning with A, and that explains why we're seeing an A here. So very often the A in question will simply be the first symbol of the X that we're expecting. But not always, okay? Because it might be, and we have already seen an example of this, it may be that the X subphrase in question is the empty string, and the A that we're seeing doesn't actually belong to the X at all. It belongs to whatever comes after the X. So if you look at, for example, the lookups here for, look up. So here we were expecting an S, and we saw a closed bracket, okay? And that tells us that the S in question has got to be empty. So the closed bracket doesn't actually belong to the S that we're expecting. It's part of what follows it. So important idea to keep in mind is this distinction between two cases, where the symbol that we're seeing is the first symbol of the phrase we're interested in, or that it's the next symbol that follows the thing that we're interested in. Now this is efficient, because once we've got ourselves a parse table, okay, having a parse table is kind of the closest you can get for context-free grammars to having a transition table for a DFA, where you simply just look up the next thing to do at each stage. You're in a state, you've got an input symbol, what you look up, what you do, next state to jump to. You can just trundle through it, pushing and popping stuff from the stack as you go. Okay, so it turns out for any fixed grammar G, it turns out that we can do parsing for a string of length n in time just proportional to the length of the string. Okay, so we can basically, if we've got as far as this, we can basically whip through our string doing parsing very efficiently. Okay, and this is, just for the record, this is an example of what's called a top-down predictive parser. Predictive because we're using the stack to predict the form, we're making a prediction about the form that the rest of the input is going to take based on what we've already seen. That's what's kind of clever about it. And top down because we end up producing a top down derivation like this. So in effect, we start from the start symbol of the grammar and we grow our tree downwards. There are other kinds of parsing algorithms which I won't go into that work the other way. They sort of start with a string of non-terminals and they look for opportunities for clumping bits together into bigger bits. And then once you clump the whole thing together into one really big bit, then you've finished. So that's what's meant by calling this top down. Okay, I've nearly caught up with myself. Let's keep going. Let's see if we get on. Okay, I haven't actually given you a formal definition of what an LL1 grammar is. So here's a formal definition. So suppose G is a context-free grammar, and just for simplicity, suppose it doesn't contain any useless non-terminals. There's a bit of small print here saying there are no non-terminals that can't be sort of used in any way. Okay. So we say G is LL1 if for any terminal A and any non-terminal X, so these are the two bits of information, there's some rule which is the right rule to apply, and that means
If we've got any sentential form that might appear in a leftmost derivation, so we've got some terminals we've produced before, so far, we've got the x staring us in the face, and then we've got some stuff after that, and the string we're being given has actually got an a at this position, then there's this rule is such that the next sentential form in this derivation has to be this x goes to alpha. So here we've replaced x here by the alpha here. So this is a way of saying this rule is the unique rule that can be applied in this context. So it's rather cumbersome, but that's the watertight definition of what it means for grammar to be LL1. Okay. I'll look next time at a grammar that's not LL1, and then the two outstanding questions are, so next time's tomorrow, how can we tell whether a grammar is LL1 or not? And if it is LL1, how can we construct one of these parse tables for it? So I haven't said yet where the parse table comes from. I've just said, well, if you've got a parse table, that's great. You can do efficient parsing. So tomorrow's lecture, we'll talk about where do parse tables actually come from? How do you actually construct them? And another issue is, if a grammar isn't LL1, is there any hope of kind of massaging it a bit, replacing it by an equivalent grammar that is LL1? And the answer is, sometimes, yes. There's a sort of art to transforming a non-LL1 grammar, in good cases at least, to an equivalent LL1 one. And that means you can it's amenable to this efficient parsing. Okay. So tomorrow I'll do I'm just one slide behind now, quite well. Or one and a half slides behind. And then we'll look at how do you know whether a grammar is LL1 and how do you make one of these parse tables? And then next Tuesday's lecture, which will be the last one before Morella takes over, will be making a grammar LL1 if it isn't already. Okay.
Hi.
I have a question about the books of this course.
Yeah.
We have this Heisenberg,
yeah.
Yeah, and the other one I can't recall the name of.
The Juraski and Martin.
Yeah, but it has two editions.
Okay. The Juraski Martin one, yeah. I believe it's the second. Yeah.
How big is the difference between both editions? Oh. Because I have the first one.
Ah.
And
okay.
The second one I have from library, but I know that I will.
Okay. In that case, you would probably know better than me what.
I haven't read it yet. What I
inherited from my predecessor in this course was that it was, if people were getting one from Cole, it was worth getting the second one. But I don't really. I mean, perhaps you can. I would say if you've got the first one, I would say see how you get on with it. Don't rush to get the second one. If given that you've already got it, I mean, I would say. To anyone else, I would say get the second one.
Ten past four tomorrow, but
There's kind of a natural progression at the end, especially winter time. It's very cold, and it's tea at home.
Sorry?
Especially winter time, a natural progression to just stay there, and just be warm, and
yeah.
And that's a good thing about it.
People submitting
Right.
Let's see anyway. Okay.